from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
President Obama said today the United States is extending a hand of friendship to the Cuban people following Castro's death.
Very scary morning, but things are slowly returning to normal on the Ohio State University campus.
I respect the brilliance and judgment and sheer instincts of President-elect Trump to form his cabinet as he wishes, but I felt compelled to come forward on behalf of the people who were weighing in.
It's completely ridiculous, and I don't think there's a big universe of people out there who support flag burning. It's terrible, and it's despicable. But the big news, though, Dr. Tom Price to run HHS and Ms. Seema Verma to run CMS.
Green Party candidate Jill Stein is questioning whether Donald Trump really won the election and is calling for a recount in key battleground states.
You can join our conversation today about the week's news at 860-275-7266. We'll be talking about some of the stories you just heard about. You'll get a chance to hear Colin McEnroe talk about Jill Stein, one of his favorite topics. Colin McEnroe is here. He's host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello once again, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Kalila Brown-Dean. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Hello there once again, Kalila.
Great to be back.
And Dan Haar is a columnist for The Hartford Current. Hello there, Danny.
Good morning.
Well, so there is a lot to talk about. Maybe we'll start, before we get into some of the Trump tweets, with some of the recent cabinet picks that we've seen coming down. A whole flurry of these. I guess I always forget, Colin, that this is what happens in the days after any election, even what we'll call a normal election. You begin to see the names that the president-elect has decided he wants to be in his cabinet. We're hearing names like Wilbur Ross, a billionaire, to be Commerce Secretary. Elaine Chao, certainly a Washington insider, to be Transportation Secretary, and lots of other names on there. Anything in this list of cabinet appointments that stands out to you?
Well, no, everything. I mean, first of all, I mean, in terms of draining the swamp, this doesn't really look to me like swamp draining. I mean, it looks like sort of repopulating the swamp with maybe a slightly different set of swamp creatures, or moving them around from one lily pad or rock to another. There aren't a lot of – there's some kind of counterintuitive picks, but there aren't a lot of surprises. I will say there's also kind of a sense that, you know, rather than – I mean, there are some new faces, and I guess Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, would kind of be one of them if you count a billionaire investor as a new face. I mean, it's not – you know, it's not like nobody's ever heard of him or anything like that, or that he's lived a life of obscurity. It is interesting to see on his calendar today is Linda McMahon. I don't know what she's coming in for. My favorite moment of the last couple of days was, I think it was BuzzFeed reported that Kellyanne Conway was entering Trump Tower with an unidentified male. It turned out to be Dan Quayle. This is how quickly people forget. Well, those kids at BuzzFeed, they don't even remember. They don't even remember 88. So, I mean, it all jumps out. I guess if I were going to pick one thing, I'd pick Tom Price, just because the one way I feel as though this administration could overplay its hand, not that there's only one way, but the one way that I think could seriously, seriously overplay the hand and create the Democratic equivalent of a 1994 Republican revenge revolution would be to really go after Medicare and possibly Social Security. Medicare would be somewhere in the crosshairs of Tom Price. It's been in the crosshairs of Paul Ryan since he was about 5 years old. If you want to see what people really get upset about, and I'm sorry to say this, but the truth is anything anybody's ever marched on Washington about before will pale before people – when you see people between the ages of 50 and, you know, the grave – start storming down there about you are not going to successfully disrupt this without causing a lot of trouble.
But that's what's so interesting about what we're seeing here is Trump obviously elected in this great populist wave, telling people a lot of things they want to hear. We keep hearing from voters all across our region, our state, our nation, saying they just want some sort of change. They want a swamp draining, etc. But when you go after something like that, even as much as many establishment Republicans have wanted to for a long time, Colin, it cuts against the very grain of what made Donald Trump Donald Trump. I mean, how does he exactly go after something like Medicare and have any success whatsoever? I don't even see that happening.
Well, so there are two people who are on record as saying that they will not disturb Medicare. One of them is Donald Trump, and the other one is Steve Bannon. Those are the two people who said that they don't see it that way. You know, Bannon, in his, you know, there are meager recent self-representations by Steve Bannon, a senior counsel now for Trump. But when he has talked a little bit about what he believes in, he couldn't be more different than Paul Ryan. You know, he says he wants to spend multi-trillion dollars on infrastructure, and he does not want to disturb those core entitlements of Medicare and Social Security. So and Trump during the campaign said the same thing. Now, Trump says so many different things that, you know, you can't really hold him necessarily. It's hard to pin him down to and say, well, you said that, because he probably said five other things that, you know, are contradictory.
Yeah. Kalilah, how about you?
Well, I think if we look at the Seema Verma pick and we get a sense of what we should expect with Medicaid changes, and again, this idea that you're going to drain the swamp by bringing in new sea creatures who worked very closely with Mike Pence in Indiana. So Indiana's provision, if you miss a payment, you pay a small fee into your health care insurance. If you miss a payment, you have a 6-month lockout from any medical coverage or insurance coverage. So if that's what happened in Indiana, that's what we should expect nationwide. And it's a real difference between who has Medicare and, you know, those people who usually have Medicare are often very stable voters versus those who need Medicaid and are viewed as being expendable in this political process. So I think people should look at the Indiana example for what's going to come, but also to think about how do you maneuver around that, particularly for states that will have to pick up a lot of that cost.
Dan?
This is like a roulette wheel. Where do you turn? Where do you look? And what do you say? Let's take Wilbur Ross and what precisely he does.
Not Wilbur Cross.
Wilbur
Ross.
Right. Does he have a highway named after him in Connecticut?
Maybe someday soon. We'll
okay.
See.
Well, we'll see.
That'll be Linda McMahon.
It depends on all that. depends on all that infrastructure statement spending. Wilbur Ross is in distressed debt, it's clear. This would be pretty much precisely the occupation that would be opposite to the ideal that Donald Trump described on the campaign to his supporters, building up America. A person who's in distressed debt, and I'm sure he's an honorable person. I'm sure that he, you know, gives money to his church or synagogue and so forth. But a person who's buying distressed debt, as a general rule, is a bottom feeder in the economy. They are taking companies in or near bankruptcy, and they're giving them as little as possible, and they're coming in and they're tearing the – what word can I use that wasn't on Colin's show yesterday? They're tearing the stuff out of them. It's appropriate that Long Wharf, I believe, or is it Yale? You know, Long Wharf is doing other people's money?
Long Wharf.
Yeah. This will be appropriate because that's precisely what this model is. The symbolism of the person coming in who has essentially never run anything. He is in a financial instrument that says, when you're in trouble, I'm going to help you out. I may keep you out of bankruptcy, but it ain't going to look like anything what you saw. And this is the worst of American capitalism. And I have absolutely nothing against either capitalism or any other ism that you want to name. It's just – it's bottom feeding, and that's not the type of commerce that the president-elect talked about.
And there's also a reason why government isn't run like a business, right? There are certain principles that guide that. There are certain things that have to be done in order to protect vulnerable people. So as I look at these new administration picks, it gives a whole new meaning to the term catfish, right? To think of the bottom feeders and who's really going to lose out. The fact that
I thought you meant they weren't real. They were like these like internet people that you were talking to.
One could hope, but it doesn't look like that's going that way, Colin. But thanks for that glimmer of hope in my life. But I think if you look at, you know, really what's at stake here, the stocks in private prisons have gone through the roof. Because it's very clear of this move toward privatization, the move toward exploiting or benefiting from people at their very worst, that happens in healthcare, that happens in mass incarceration, it's going to happen across the board.
Two quick things. One, I would predict maybe the biggest confirmation fight, oddly enough, considering he's one of their colleagues, might be over Jeff Sessions. Sessions, you know, and if you wanted to think about somebody who's maybe a potentially dangerous guy as heading up the Justice Department, one difference between the Justice Department and some other things I'm about to talk about is you can have a huge impact in the Justice Department by not doing stuff, right? You can say, I'm not going to enforce civil rights laws, and you can instruct your staff to do that. And that's not really exactly an initiative. It's just a reallocation of resources. And so a guy like Sessions, who, you know, maybe isn't committed to some of those same ideas that you've seen during the Obama administration, really could have a pretty major impact right away. Now, a lot of these other people, It has to be noted. Elaine Chao would be an exception. But a lot of these other people, when you come in and you don't have any government experience, and as Danny says, and sometimes you don't even really have any experience running anything, in a way, for a year, 18 months, you're going to be very beholden to the permanent government of Washington, the core staff people who've been there forever and actually do know how your department operates. And going in there and trying to do things by imperial fiat tends not to work all that well because there's just all this stuff there that you don't understand. That's not how we do it. That's not, you know, you need to do this first. You need to do that first. They'll be very beholden.
That's illegal.
Yeah, that's illegal. Now, yeah, I don't know that that's an impediment anymore. But yeah, so I mean, a lot of these people who are coming in with no federal experience, a guy like Mnuchin, you know, at Treasury, he's really going to have to listen for a long time to the pre-existing staff there before he can start flailing around doing stuff he wants to do.
Colin mentioned Elaine Chao, former Labor Secretary under Bush. Here's what Dan Malloy said. I was reading in the Connecticut Mirror. He said, "The health of our nation's transportation system is integral to our economic prosperity. We need a strong leader and partner at the helm of the Federal Department of Transportation who understands the importance of our infrastructure to the vitality of our communities and industries." Malloy said Secretary Chao's considerable experience as a Deputy Secretary of Transportation is encouraging. We look forward to working with her. So Dan Malloy seems encouraged by the new Transportation Secretary. That's maybe an important position if we're talking about this massive infrastructure funding that Colin was talking about before.
Secretary Chao visited the Hartford-Kant in 2002 with several bright ideas, one of them which I wrote about back at the time was she wanted to change the way OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, that is the agency that checks for safety at factories and other workplaces, and often what they do is make a surprise visit. And so, you know, if you have vats of open battery acid and banana peels all over the place.
Like they do at the Hartford Current, by the way.
Well, no, we can't afford that stuff. So we don't have any of that. So if you have all that around, you know, you're going to get cited. You're going to get fined. And so that's pretty much the way OSHA operates.
Yeah.
And she wanted to make it a more, in her words, cooperative environment and tell companies when OSHA is coming and schedule visits so that everybody could work together on worker safety. Which makes sense when you think about it for about 3 seconds. Kalila turned her head before the 3 second. and so that actually that for some reason that wasn't something she was able to get done. But 1 year later in 2003, she attempted to and partly succeeded in removing overtime rights from 650,000 American workers. So this is a person who's dangerous in the sense that she's phenomenally charming and has a great immigration story, oldest of six, came from Taiwan, didn't have a lot of money, rose up, went to great schools, made good, is very, very smart, but dangerous.
I want to bring up a name that we always like to talk about if possible. Joe Lieberman actually weighs in and starts talking about Donald Trump's picks. Is there any chance, Colin, that we actually see, as Joe Lieberman inserts himself once again into this conversation, that Joe Lieberman comes back into some sort of national prominence, maybe even in a Trump administration?
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Dankowski.
Yes.
Have you seen those movies like Halloween and Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street?
Oh,
where
sure.
Jason
sure.
and Michael Myers, yeah. And they just always keep coming back. You think they're dead. And then there's another movie.
The credits and roll, and then there's something else, yeah.
You are not going to get rich betting on the final demise of Joe Lieberman. And, you know, I mean, he's been praising. Not that anyone asked him what he thought, but he's been praising the selection of Katie McFarlane what is she? She's Deputy NSA? NSA.
Yep.
So, by the way, she got suckered the other day. She retweeted a fake Rudy Giuliani account, and the account was like, it said Rudy Giuliani, but then it was at XXXXX238555. I mean, just clearly, you're going to be the deputy director of the NSA, and that doesn't jump out to you as a fake account? That makes me a little bit nervous. But anyway, he has been praising her based on, I don't know, she's married to one of his Yale classmates, so that's obviously he really vetted her. And, you know, he is the kind of guy that maybe they'd find something for.
Do you share the concerns over whether it's Jeff Sessions or the pick for Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, someone who is in Trump's words, passionate about school choice, and many people's words, you know, passionate about tearing down the system that we have currently for public education?
So I wrote a piece for WEAA that's called Justice Trumped, and it was all about what this Jeff Sessions appointment could mean. So you could be like a John Ashcroft and refuse to investigate any voting rights claims. And so then you have Native Americans who are disenfranchised. So that inaction becomes just as important. Sessions has made it clear that he's going to be very active. So, you know, according to him, only stupid people smoke marijuana. Well, all those states that have just legalized, or even Connecticut that's promoted medical marijuana, it's going to make a difference at the federal level. And I think for, you know, the new education secretary, her idea of school choice is to, again, promote charters, privatization, and you only need to look at the Detroit public school system to see the impact of her direct action. A billionaire with no public school experience, no educational background, will have an immediate impact, too.
Did you have a thought, Dan?
Yes, I'm going to turn slightly less negative in the hope in feeding the glimmer. This is a group of people who, in contrast to what some of us had feared, is actually, with DeVos, it's pretty experienced at what they do, not at government, at what they do, and they tend to be very intelligent. So it's sort of – I had expected to see a contrast between the Reagan group, you know, Reagan and Deaver and so forth, who came in 30 years ago, 35, 37, and this. And in fact, this is a group of pretty smart people. Now, that's good and bad, depending on whether you think of what they're doing as good. But what the common theme across the board is, these are people who are committed to putting a whole lot of money into selected private hands. And that can be good or bad. That's what we were talking about with infrastructure. It is not necessarily a bad thing to put a whole lot of money into selected private hands.
You know, I could sort of feed that glimmer a tiny bit. I mean, it's definitely a glimmer. Even sort of reading today, I guess we're going to get to the carrier deal a little bit later, but reading today about what, you know, some of Trump's economic policies, and I guess I put quote marks around economic policies, are, I find myself thinking, well, I don't really know that these won't work. And I mean, although people that I admire and trust, like Adam Davidson, tell me that that you kind of have to have a certain level of global trade. And so I'm inclined to believe them. But I don't really know at the level of empirical knowledge that some of the protectionist thinking of Wilbur Ross and Donald Trump won't work or won't have some short-term benefits. I mean, I can't say that with confidence. I don't understand trade well enough. I don't understand what it means. I mean, one of the things that Trump seems to be trying to do is negotiate with some of the people who offshore a lot of their holdings, see if he can get some of this money back into the country. I couldn't sit here and tell you that won't work.
I wanted to turn quickly before we have to take a break to one of the threads that, of course, the media is kind of tied up in over the course of this last week is that we've never had a president or a president-elect. Well, we've never had anything like this at all, but we've never had someone who tweets as much as Donald Trump does. And so every couple minutes, it seems, Kalila, there's another tweet that comes out that, again, if it was coming from a Barack Obama, you might think, well, this is someone who has field-tested the idea, run it through a couple official channels, and is tweeting it as a way to signal that this is actually what he means policy-wise. But and I don't even want to read through the entire list of them. We'll get to a few specifics. But Donald Trump tweets about so many things that are contradictory to the things he said before or things that people who he's pointing to in his administration are saying right now. Should we even be paying attention on a minute-by-minute to these tweets in a way that we would to just about any other leader that we've ever seen in American or world history?
I think so, because I think it gives us an indication of not just his thought process, but from where he is pulling this information with no real consideration for fact, for truth, and also for impact. So that if you're tweeting that people should go to jail or lose their citizenship for burning the American flag, someone has to be in his ear to say, but wait a minute, there's a whole First Amendment that governs this. The Supreme Court decided this, and how it makes his followers and his supporters respond. I mean, I personally would like if these political leaders and officials would withdraw from social media for a while, because it does become hard to decipher what they really mean versus the spur of the moment impulse to tweet.
And Dan, I'll say, you know, the one that I think raised the most interest over the course of the last week or so is the tweet that says, in addition to winning the Electoral College in a landslide, I won the popular vote if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally. A lot of people say that's just meant to distract from other news that we could be paying attention to. But here's what happened, is the president-elect of the United States just said something that is categorically not true, something that has no factual basis whatsoever, and put it out there as fact. And now we're reacting to it as though we have to prove something that has been proven time and time again, that there is indeed no structural voter fraud in America, certainly not in the millions and millions of voters.
That you're only saying that because you don't know about the Venezuelan connection, in which millions of votes were sent in electronically to the for Hillary in various swing state electronic districts that were hacked, and so you just haven't heard that.
I just haven't heard that.
Yes. I do want to say that the tweet culture is not.
He
just
was joking, by the way.
I understand.
No, I know you understand. I'm thinking about the listeners.
Okay. So the thank you for that, Colin. I just want to quickly point out that the Twitter culture has taken root. United Technologies, which is not known for this, last night is. Elected to use Twitter to break the news that it had reached an agreement with the Trump administration, or the incoming Trump administration, mainly I think it was Mike Pence, because what we're going to find most likely is that was a state payment, very similar to the types of deals that Governor Malloy has made in the First Five, Next Five program. And it's probably going to look like that, and rather than a structural reform. We don't know that yet, but I thought it was comical that CNBC Faber tweeted this news, not with a retweet of UTC, but with his own tweet at 7:08 saying breaking news, and later claimed CNBC broke the news first. So did CNBC break the news, or did on the same very same platform did UTC?
Well, and we'll get maybe to some of the specifics of the deal in the next section, but I'd love you to weigh in on this, Colin.
So Jack Schaefer wrote a piece about this for Politico, press critic Jack Schaefer, basically saying, yeah, we're paying way too much attention to his tweets. It's a problem, though. It's not something you can swear off that easily. I think it's also a problem on the other side. I imagine that every intemperate thought that Lyndon Baines Johnson ever had became public. I don't think that we would have gotten through an incredibly complex and troubling history period in American history even as calmly as we did, and it wasn't all that calm. But imagine every time that he got mad about something, or like everybody knew it, you know, and that's sort of what's happening right now. So, yeah, you have Trump. I mean, first of all, you know, you have things that are kind of alarming, like the tweet that you're describing. When you win an election, you tend not to question its validity. That's what most people would think anyway. In other words, if you win an election, you don't say, oh, there was a lot of illegal voting in this election that I just won. I mean, it's such a crazy thing to do. And then that also turned into this kind of proven negative flame war with one specific reporter, I think it was Jeff Zelensky, saying, where Trump was saying, prove I'm wrong about that. Well, it's
not the way it works.
No, it's very difficult to prove a negative anyway. I mean, what proof do you have that there was illegal voting? The plus side of this is you do get to know a lot about how his mind works. I don't know whether that's useful or not, but let's assume that it's useful. For example, today he's been tweeting in the early morning about how he is going to make some kind of break with his private business. And the third tweet said that it was visually important. And he said, you know, it's just a good visual or something, which is, once again, the kind of thing that you typically don't admit. I'm doing this for the optics. You know, it's not – which, I mean, the implication also is that there isn't any real substance to it and that he doesn't really think it's particularly important to
do. But that's refreshing. The idea that he would actually tell us that he's doing it just for the optics, that's actually refreshing. The thing about the millions and millions of fraudulent votes, not so refreshing, Kalila. Ridiculously scary on almost all levels. I can't even imagine how anything could be more scary than saying that we essentially had an illegitimate election in America.
Well, and for me, my focus is not so much on Trump, but on the supporters who latch on to this and say, that's right, this was fraud. Well, if that's the case, then that invalidates his win, and maybe we should have a do-over
of
the entire
election. That's what I'm thinking. Let's have a do-over.
Let's have a do-over. Why not?
I'm down with that.
Tag, you're it. So there's secret ballots. There's no way of knowing that that ballot that you claim was fraudulent was a vote for Hillary Clinton as opposed to a vote for Donald Trump. So that's, again, where I want voters, where I want constituents to take a step back and say, wait a minute, think it, don't tweet it.
As we get a more heightened world of media scrutiny, ironically, because since there are fewer people in the media, but sort of a more immediacy in media coverage, I would draw a comparison between this and video replay in sports. We're coming to see that more and more big plays in more and more big games are decided by the video replay. And we're sort of starting to see that here, where it's all going to be about the process and not about who wins and who loses, because close victories, of course, by definition, are close victories on the margin. The margin is in the technology.
Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do is take a break and then come back to that idea about going to the replay, including the replay that Jill Stein is trying to get in a number of different states, recounts in various states after this election. We're also going to talk a bit about foreign policy and talk about what happened in Cuba with Fidel Castro passing away finally after so many years, and some of the reactions from American politicians as well to that. We also want to talk about this deal with United Technologies and Donald Trump. A lot to talk about in the Wheelhouse with Danny Haar from the Hartford Current, with Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, and with our own Colin McEnroe. This is the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Today, we're talking with Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, Dan Haar from the Hartford Current, and our own Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WMPR. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
We're calling it Cut Off from Shore. We're first of all going to look at a process by which a group of potential astronauts for long-term missions were isolated, placed in a sort of, you know, in an enclosure where they had no contact with the rest of the world. We'll talk a little bit about what that's all about, how you train people that way. Then we're also going to talk about this tiny little platform out in the sea, in the North Sea, not too far from Great Britain, which has declared itself a country. It's changed hands a few times, sometimes at gunpoint. It's like about the size, about half the size of the third floor here at WNPR. But people, you know, land on it with shotguns and drive off other people.
My sense is that after that show today, you might have some people calling and asking how they can sign up.
Right.
How can I sign up to get off the grid for a little bit? Just get away from the world.
This is by producer Josh Nalea, and I often don't understand what the shows are about until I do them. But they're always good.
It will be good this afternoon at 1 o'clock. Hey, here's something you always like to talk about. You had some choice words about Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate during the presidential campaign. Of course, she did not take a whole lot of votes in any of the states where she ran, but she did take votes in these several tens of thousands, and in some cases people were saying that Jill Stein had an impact on this election. Now she and the Green Party seem to be leading the way in a recount. What do you make of this recount notion, Colin, given what we were just talking about, Danny Haar saying, look, we are in replay society now. Almost every vote is going to be contested. Almost every election is now going to go maybe to the courts. What do you see in the recount?
Well, this is rolled out in the worst possible way. Jill Stein started raising money for this, I think saying initially she needed $2.5 million. She's now got, I think, $6.4 million. She's now claiming she needs more, although then it's not clear really whether all of it will be spent on the recount. She may have other plans for this money. That those plans will be heavily regulated by the FEC. So, I mean, if you wanted to, start at a slightly discredited basis, I mean, like all this the craziness of the fundraising. I will say, maybe in Jill Stein's defense, or at least as a counter argument, I hope the FEC does, or somebody should investigate how these states decide what they're going to charge. Like, you know, I mean, Wisconsin is now talking about it costing maybe $3.5 million to do. So maybe she's right. Maybe she does need that money. Or $2.5 million is another number. But Michigan, which I think is a bigger state, I think has more people in it, theirs costs like a million or less. It's like a bargain. So I know, like, how do they decide these things? But anyway, I mean, so right away, you've got this sort of fuzziness. Like, where's the money going? What are you doing with the money? The other thing about recounts is that you really have to know what you're doing. This is really a high expertise level question. If you just go in there looking for stuff and you don't have, ask Ron Klain about Florida in 2000. If you don't know exactly what you're looking for and how to do this, you're not going to get anywhere. And the last thing I would say is, you know, Wisconsin isn't going to do it. She'd have to flip, you know, some more states in order to do it. I don't think that's particularly likely in Pennsylvania. What is it, 70,000 votes, something like that? It's pretty hard to do a recount. I mean, there would have to be, you know, Venezuelan hacking for there to be a 70,000 vote flip in Pennsylvania.
Well, I think if you think about the NFL, if you question a ruling and you go to the replay and the ruling stands, there's a penalty for that.
Jill Stein should lose a timeout.
She should lose a timeout, right?
But I thought she should get a timeout.
That'd be nice. But it's a rare form of that. I think it knocks the credibility of not Jill Stein, but really what the Green Party has been pushing for over this last year, of pushing for national recognition, a national movement of the Green Party so that it's not just state to state. So if this is the focus and not what other leaders are saying, we need to focus on party building and not just this election, that could really hurt them in the long run.
Danny?
Just first a number. Jill Stein won 31,000 votes in Wisconsin, and Hillary Clinton lost by what looks now like 22,000. So whether that made a difference, we don't know. But those are the numbers, and those are pretty significant potential numbers there. I read the piece by the professor, the computer science professor from Michigan, Haldeman. Right? Halderman, I did Halderman, check.
Yeah.
He's not related to H.R. Yeah. Haldeman. I did check that. So just in case there was any conspiracy theory. And he himself does not actually, in his piece that he wrote, I believe it was on his blog, it may have been published somewhere, he believes that he does not believe that there was hacking. What he did was he raised the point about the discrepancy between the 7 percentage point difference between the electronic voting locations and the paper ballot optical counting locations in Wisconsin and I believe Michigan. He, in his piece, said he doesn't believe there was actual hacking, but that we need to check these things. And again, the question is, how do you check?
Well, and we probably do need to check these things and find a way to do that. I'd also like to find out how much Connecticut would charge for a recount. What's our price? I don't even know.
I think we should be a low-cost state in this.
I know, exactly. Among the various things that happened this week, Fidel Castro passes away. Donald Trump, of course, tweets about this. If Cuba unwilling to make a better deal for the Cuban people, Cuban-American people and the U.S. as a whole, I will terminate the deal. Here's Chris Murphy talking about Donald Trump and Cuba and what happens next in that relationship.
I hope that if he starts attending these briefings on America's role in the world, what he will find is that our entire influence, our entire role in Central and South America is predicated upon this continued thawing of relations with Cuba. 140 characters can't describe the impact that a new shutdown of relations with Cuba would have on America's broader security interests in Central and South America.
So what do we make of this? This monumental moment in Cuban history and obviously world history, Fidel Castro finally passing away. And now Donald Trump and I'm sure many, many Republicans and not just those in the Trump administration saying now's the time to reopen up some of the loosening that President Obama has had over the course of the last couple of years in that relationship. What do we make of this and how important a relationship is this, do you think, Kalila?
Well, I think it's interesting that no one is really talking about what this means to the Cuban people, either on the island of Cuba or throughout the United States, and how difficult and how complicated this is. You know, I just picture the very worst of people flying into Havana, seeing the beautiful vintage cars, and then a large twinkling Trump sign that says, you know, welcome to Trumpville, Cuba. But I think it is also about what's at stake in terms of a backlash toward Obama versus forward progress for the country, for the people of Cuba, and what we see as sort of a global rejection of human rights violations.
It's an emotional thing, I think, you know, for an awful lot of people. It's hard to see how either side, any side of this complex question of Fidel Castro's legacy and death leads to anything other than a further opening. It's hard to see that.
This might be an example of a tweet we shouldn't have bothered to cover. I don't think he knows what he's talking about. I don't think he knows what his policies towards Cuba are. It might be added that Fidel Castro hasn't been running the country for a heck of a long time. So I'm not really sure why it's some huge watershed moment that he died. And I think once he gets in office, he's going to figure out whether a bell like this one is something that he can unring. My guess is he can't.
Carrier Corporation now says it will keep some of the jobs in Indiana. It was threatening to move after meeting with Donald Trump. It's not clear what incentives have been promised by the administration or by VP-elect and outgoing Indiana Governor Mike Pence. So as we've talked about on the show many times, we alluded to earlier, Dan, this issue of states playing against one another, holding governors for ransom unless they pay up. Well, now this is happening at the federal level. The president-elect getting involved and saying, it might be in your best business interests to move jobs elsewhere, UTC carrier, but we would like you to keep jobs here, and directly intervening. What happens next?
The promise on the campaign trail by Trump when he made his famous 100% chance that carrier is going to keep these jobs in Indiana statement, I believe back in April, the promise was that it was going to be done by something other than just giving companies money to stay, that it was going to be a change in policy. Specifically, it was going to be done by tariffs of up to 35% against those products coming from Mexico, which would pretty much do the deal. you know, that would have the effect. Now, we can argue about that tariff policy all day, but the fact is that what we see now is that it doesn't appear that this was the result of any policy change, or else it wouldn't have been a series of private negotiations of the sort that we see every day in states. It was probably a payoff, and that's unfortunate for the notion of change. But it is what it is.
When you say payoff, I assume you mean some kind of tax abatements or
– It appears that that's what it is. We don't know yet. But it doesn't appear to have been a sweeping policy change that led UTC to change its mind.
Right. And I think you're right. And I think the thing that alarms me about this is, you know, Trump – this is one of the ways in which Trump's a newbie, right? Like, we've all seen this game happen over and over and over again. And we've seen it happen here in Connecticut. I think we all have our own opinions about how well it works. But, you know, this is Trump's first opportunity to see if – you know, bribing companies, I don't mean that literally, to stay in a particular place is an effective economic policy. It might take a while before he realizes that that's a bucket with a hole in it, and we'll have to live through all that. The other thing you're seeing here, I mean, he is not even in office yet, but you're seeing the way he is going to do a sack dance in the end zone anytime he does anything. Like, this isn't really a lot of jobs. You know, I mean, like, when we think about the job creation under Obama, which has been huge, it's been low-wage jobs. But, you know, if Barack Obama went in the end zone and did a sack dance every time he saved 1,000 or 2,000 jobs, that's all he'd be doing. But this is the way Trump is going to govern. Anytime he does anything remotely impressive, he is going to throw a parade for himself.
I just had a visual of Donald Trump doing the dab in the Oval Office. Sorry.
I'm thinking Mark Gastineau.
You know, that would be
I guess you don't do sack dances in the end zone unless it's a safety.
But to keep with the sports analogy, we've seen how this fails with sports teams. When you give them some sort of cash inducement to keep the team there, you improve the stadium, but you don't change the policy, then it becomes a temporary fix. So the next 2 years or 3 years, the deal becomes sweeter, and the people who get left behind are the states that can't compete.
Yeah, I'm not ready to condemn corporate greenmail just yet. We've had some pretty good deals, including Bridgewater in Connecticut, which saved a whole lot of money. The point is that that's not national policy, and that's really what he promised.
Talking about national policy quickly, Dan, you've written about this U.S. Justice Department named Connecticut, California, and 8 large metro areas as illegal sanctuary jurisdictions earlier this year in a report that heightened tensions over enforcement against undocumented immigrants after it was released. It could mean the end of tens of millions of dollars in annual federal aid to the states. Is Connecticut somehow in violation of federal immigration law?
That's precisely what the report says. And the report says that the Justice Department should withhold millions of dollars. I think it was $69 million that Connecticut received. That was the fiscal year 15 number. We don't know what it is now. But should be withheld not all federal grants, but the money from the Justice Department. Justice Department, like a lot of departments, energy, education, gives its own money to states. And I did a big, lengthy series of investigations. I picked up the phone and called Mike Lawler. And he said, no, actually, this was all a big mistake. And that's the column that we had posted yesterday. This is a mistake. What they did was they Googled the Trust Act. Connecticut passed something in 2013 called the Trust Act in response to more aggressive treatment of immigration issues by ICE, which resulted itself from connecting ICE to the fingerprint database of the FBI, mm-hmm. and that was under previous policy. The ICE started saying, hey, local jurisdiction, Connecticut, New Haven, whoever you are, hold this prisoner, don't let him go, give us 2 days to get there. And states generally have reacted by saying, if you got a warrant, yeah, or if it's a felony, yeah, or if it's a person on a terrorist watch list, yeah, otherwise we're not holding him for you. And different states, including Connecticut, passed laws to this effect. Connecticut's was called the Trust Act. They Googled the Trust Act. They saw a version of it that said, we will prohibit cooperation with ICE. That was a version that never even got voted on. They made a mistake. That just illustrates how crazy and messy this is, not just in the Trump administration, folks.
That's
right.
It's
Obama, too. This was the Obama administration.
And I think if you look at the fact that more people were deported under the Obama administration than previous administrations, you get a sense that this is a bipartisan commitment to doing this, even if the factual part is wrong. But it also raised the issue of who pays for this. So should states and localities have to pay the cost of holding people for the federal government to make a decision? And if we are now in the era of affirming states' rights, this completely challenges what that'll mean economically.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we are in the era of affirming states' rights.
We we're trying to get a glimpse.
We might be. We talked about that last week.
I know.
So, yeah, I'm trying to picture Elliot Ness like typing Al Capone into Google. This guy's pretty bad. We got to go after him. But the one thing that I will say that I think you might see a consistent pattern here is the use of the punitive use of federal aid, right? I mean, so we talked a little bit, I think, last week about universities that are thinking about setting up sanctuary campuses and stuff like that, which, you know, again, I mean, if Trump's policy turns out to be not that different from Obama's, then you're sort of back to what Dan's talking about, you know, which is, yeah, you got an outstanding warrant. Well, you're probably not going to, you know, keep that person at Wesleyan anyway. But the fact is Wesleyan gets a lot of money from the federal government, and we know something about the temperament of the president-elect. I think he would have no trouble enacting a very punitive policy about withholding federal aid to people who and institutions and towns and cities and states that don't do what he wants.
I just want to quickly get to a phone call. Jeff's in Coventry. Hey, Jeff.
Good morning, everybody. Just wanted to bring up that something that you haven't talked about yet, and that is, let me just step back for a second. Does anyone find it ironic that this president-elect that was a candidate talking so much about how we want to get away from being politically correct all of a sudden wants to punish people now for burning the flag, the ultimate in political incorrectness? So I just wanted to get your comments about that.
Well, it's interesting, Kalila. You know, Colin said earlier that it may be one of the tweets that we should have ignored was the tweet about Fidel Castro. He doesn't really know much about Cuba policy right now. Maybe he should hold his fire and we should not pay attention. I've sort of taken the role of like not really paying attention over the course of the last 24 hours, has it been, since he tweeted about flag burners maybe losing their rights. I don't know. Jeff in Coventry says it's maybe something we should take a look at.
I think, again, and I agree with Jeff, that we should take a look at it, and not by focusing on Trump, but by focusing on how quickly people latched onto this and ran with this. You know, we talk about social media. I have a very good friend who's a veteran who was attacked on Facebook for saying what I fought for as a veteran was for people's right to decide what they wanted to do. I don't agree with flag burning, but I will defend, and I defended, gave my life to defend their ability to do that. And it quickly resonates with people. This is unpatriotic. This is what's wrong with our country. Yes, you should lose citizenship. So it is hypocritical, but it's also not surprising.
If Donald Trump wants to spend his time focusing on flag burning, only to lose in the Supreme Court, because I don't see Alito, I don't see Roberts voting. If he wants to spend his time fighting that fight, the world will probably be a better place in the end, because it means there's something else he won't be doing.
This whole idea of revoking your citizenship—that's like some, you know, paper some eighth grader would hand in to a civics teacher who would tell him, well, no, you couldn't do that. So, I mean, I think this is a tweet we should ignore. It's a crap issue, you know. And I mean, there isn't any kind of epidemic of flag burning going on right now. I'm reminded a little bit of the, 1988 campaign where Roger Ailes and Lee Atwater turned the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, into this gigantic issue involving Michael Dukakis. Who cares? You know, we've got a lot of other big problems right now. It's the kind of issue you bring up when you want to distract people and get them fired up about nothing.
Like the sanctity of Christmas. We've got that issue to
right.
deal with.
Oh, now you had to bring it up. Now people want to talk about it in the last segment
what
of the Wheelhouse.
What color is your coffee cup?
We're gonna take a break. Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University. Dan Harr from Hartford Current with his blue coffee cup. Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show. When we come back, we're going to talk about, well, maybe let's look ahead to the 2020 presidential election and a local boy perhaps getting into the race. And we're also going to talk about some of the other issues we haven't talked about yet in this week's News in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show, Dan Harr from The Hartford Current, and Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University. Among your alma maters is The Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. And after a really big win in a football game that I think had everyone on campus and in the diaspora very excited, something else happened on campus over the course of this last week that was enormously troubling and probably will have some long-term repercussions and implications for students on that campus. A young man drives into a crowd, injures people, gets out with a butcher knife and begins attacking them, 11 people in all injured. Your reaction to this happening again on a campus that was riding high in the way that only one that wins a big college football game kind of can, and then is, see it be in the national news like this?
Well, it was frightening and it was troubling because I have so many friends who are still at The Ohio State University, and the info was coming in and some of it was incorrect and we just didn't know. But I think the real lesson from that was listening to the professor who was attacked, who said, I want to know why this young man did this. It was a horrible event. It was tragic. It was disgusting. But the resilience of that student body, of the professor and the population, so that now students are looking forward to both of my alma maters face off tonight in basketball. Mm. So, you know, I feel like it's a win-win. And I think Ohio State really needs a win to bring that campus back together and to figure out what they do. Columbus has one of the largest Somali immigrant populations of any place in the United States. And there have been a lot of challenges for that community in terms of integrating within Columbus. So I think we can learn from this and not rush to a judgment of labeling it as something until we really know.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that was just most troubling to me was listening to the students that NPR talked to on that day when campus closed down, and some of them were Muslim students, some of them were Somali students, and just saying, I dread tomorrow. I dread what it's going to be like, and I dread how I'm going to be reacted to in the absence of a whole lot of information about what exactly happened.
And it was the fear of how they would be judged, of having their fellow students looking at them wondering, will you be next? Or do you agree with what he did? Did you know him? Did you know about this? And I think we see that in a lot of these types of campus events.
One thread here is that you have to shake your head at why the emergency services office tweeted, run, hide, fight. And that's just a real head scratcher. The second thing I would bring up is both sides of the gun control argument movement are using this to bolster their own viewpoint. Obviously, if instead of a knife it had been an AR-15, more people would have died. Equally obviously, he created mayhem without. I would seem to think that this is an argument for gun control, and I would wonder whether he tried to get a gun and failed.
Yeah, I think run, hide, fight is kind of state of the art right now. Just in the sense that you the first thing you do is you try to get out of there. The next thing you do, you hide. But if the guy bursts into the bathroom and there's three of you in there, then you fight because you have no other choice. So I think that's what that means.
Because the political merry-go-round never, ever, ever ends, we're already getting these pieces that say, who should we be thinking about for the 2020 nomination for president? And on, I'm sure, some very, very lengthy lists, Colin, Chris Murphy's name comes up. And I guess I don't think it's all that surprising at this point.
No, I don't either. Chris Saliza did that list. He writes The Fix. He's from Weathersfield originally. He's from around here somewhere.
That's right, yeah.
But he does that for the Washington Post. He did a first list, kind of a short list of people who might run in 2020. And then when you do that, everybody's people in Washington call you up and go, well, what about my guy? You didn't have my guy on that list. So then he had to do a whole other list because people called him up probably and yelled at him. So Chris Murphy was on that second list. I mean, it's really premature. You don't even know what will happen in the midterm elections. You don't know whether by 2019, you know, Wall Street and Battery Park could be physically underwater. You know, there could be like horrible things going on where you need a specific kind of candidate to run against a record of the existing administration. I will say that there's a lot of Northeasterners on these lists, with Governor Cuomo in New York, Kirsten Gillibrand in New York, Cory Booker, of course, is perennially on these lists, and now you got Murphy.
And what do you make of Murphy being on that list, Kalilah?
Well, I think, again, it is very premature, but it shows the very positive profile he's building nationally. And this idea that the party needs someone who is younger and fresher to be able to overcome some of those challenges.
And also somebody not clearly afraid of sort of getting into a fight, which he does quite often now, it seems, on cable television shows, Dan.
Well, that's right. Michelle Obama was also on the list. She was on the first list of six. And quickly, she didn't say anything. But Barack Obama, the president, said, no, she's not running. So we'll see. We'll see about that. The other thing I would make a point about, which I said a month ago before the election at this very microphone, is if Senator Chris Murphy wants to be taken seriously, and we don't know whether he does as a potential presidential candidate, he needs to get out of the Senate, become the governor of Connecticut between 2018 and 2022, have run something and not been a legislator his entire career, and then go back into the fray.
Interesting. So, Colin, a last word. We got maybe about 45 seconds. Anything you want to leave us here with today?
I'll quickly plug three things. One of them is the movie Arrival, which both you and I have seen.
Yes.
Beautiful, sad, interesting, not your typical visitors from outer space movie. at all. The movie Some Luck by Jane Smiley, which follows one Iowa family. It's a historical novel. And it goes year by year by year by year through the Depression and World War II and afterwards. And then quickly tonight, this is completely free. You do have to kind of register, I think, with Watkinson School. John Meacham, the Pulitzer Prize winning biographer, and I will be on stage at Infinity Hall. So if you call WatkinsonSchool.org and reserve a seat, it costs you absolutely nothing, courtesy of Richard Plepler, CEO of HBO.
That's a very, very cool event. And I will just say that hopefully you can join me at the Connecticut Forum tomorrow night. I'm going to be on stage talking about the future of higher education with, among others, the former Education Secretary Arne Duncan, a guy who is substantially taller than me, from what I understand. So looking forward to that. But that's tomorrow evening at the Connecticut Forum. I want to thank our guests, Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show, Dan Haar from The Hartford Current. Thanks so much, Danny.
Thank you.
And thanks also to Kalila Brown, Dean from Quinnipiac University. Thank you, Kalila.
Thank you.
Thanks to the cameras of CTN, Katie Tolarski, who is the executive producer of our programs here at WNPR, for all of her help today. This is The Wheelhouse.